Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. First, in moments, Jason Wilson on the scene in Burns, Oregon, will tell us about that militia occupation of a seasonally deserted bird sanctuary. And at the bottom of the hour, the historian Toby Jones will do a Saudi Arabia 101. First, the militia. Over the weekend after New Year's Day, a small group of armed ranchers occupied the headquarters building of the 300-square-mile Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in a remote, cold, and snowy corner of Oregon. The immediate catalyst for the action was news that two ranchers, Dwight Hammond and his son Stephen, were being ordered back to prison over a 2012 conviction for arson. They said they had set the fires to manage their land, but the federal government didn't buy their story and charged them under the Clinton-era Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, a ghoulish and surreal title for a law, if there ever was one. The Hammonds were released after serving relatively short sentences imposed by the trial judge, but the feds were not happy and insisted that they be sent back to prison for full 5-year terms, the mandatory minimum under the law. Their neighbors were outraged by the severity of the sentences and organized a peaceful demonstration to make that point. From that demonstration, a group led by Ammon Bundy, son of the Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy, famous for a 2014 standoff with federal officials over grazing rights and government-owned land, announced that they were mad as hell and weren't going to take it anymore. They marched off to the wildlife refuge and took over a stone cabin, which, incidentally, was built by the Civilian Conservation Corps, a 1930s New Deal program. I have no political sympathy for the Bundys or their ilk. They hate the idea of public ownership and ecological responsibility, things that I support. They want total freedom to exploit land for private profit. But the outburst of punitive sentiments I heard coming from my friends on the left stunned me. There were calls to retake the cabin by force, an opportunity to broaden the constituency opposed to mandatory minimum sentences, one of the drivers of mass incarceration, was lost amid the urge to jail the occupiers. The rationale seemed to be that since the government would have incinerated a group of black or Muslim occupiers, these white guys deserve the same treatment. I don't get this at all. Not being incinerated should not be a privilege, it should be a right enjoyed by all of us. I'm also not a libertarian, but there are several things I agree with principled and serious libertarians on, and one of them is opposition to the carceral state. Another is their opposition to imperial war and state surveillance. But many on the left reject any alliance with libertarians on these sorts of issues because they just don't like the rest of their pro-capitalist agenda. Well, I don't like it either. But politics is about changing the world, not asserting your moral purity. And if you can find allies in fighting mass incarceration, I say you join up with them. Okay, on to the first interview. Jason Wilson is a journalist based in Portland, Oregon, who writes frequently for The Guardian. He's been in Burns since the beginning of the occupation. Apologies for the cell phone audio, but that's all we could manage from a small town in the middle of nowhere. Jason Wilson. Welcome, Jason. Set the scene for us. Where are these guys hanging out?
They're at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, which is around 30 miles south and a little east of Burns, Oregon. Burns itself is already pretty remote. It's a 5-hour drive from Portland and not an easy one. And that's a little further out still. So They're in the middle of nowhere, essentially, and there just happens to be a headquarters there for the wildlife preserve, and they've taken that over. They've occupied it, and they're not allowing law enforcement in. No one's coming out, and they're pretty cagey about letting reporters in at the moment as well.
But they're having daily press conferences?
They are. It was very strange to see that. I was actually the first person on the scene. I happened to be here. I thought I was going to be doing a feature on the protest, the non-violent protest that happened on New Year's Day. But then a group of them, led by Ammon Bundy, went out there and occupied it. I got there on the first day, and they were toting guns as they locked the place down. But now they've since transitioned to this kind of sunshine policy. There's not a gun in sight. They're having daily press conferences. They're flattering the media. They're trying to put as nice a face as possible on it. They're actually you know, pretty good at media management, and I guess that's as a result of the experience that they got in the Bundy Ranch situation.
And the weather has been fairly brutal, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's currently snowing, actually. It's been quite cold. Not as cold as it was on Saturday, but yeah, it's been quite cold, you know, around freezing or lower the whole time. And we reported today that the authorities are shutting the power off, so it's going to be pretty chilly out there for them.
And how many guys are there, and what are they like?
That's impossible to confirm. They're not saying, for obvious reasons. I mean, they want to maintain that tactical advantage. There were early reports of up to 150 people. There's no way that there's that many people out there. On the first day, I saw around a dozen and about a dozen vehicles parked up. There are undoubtedly more people there now. People are coming from around the country to join them. But I would be very surprised if there were more than 30 people out there. As to who they are, what they're like, Ammon Bundy himself, you know, came to our attention when he was involved in the standoff at his father's ranch. They're members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They're Mormons of a particular stripe. Ideologically, they're pretty much on the same page as groups like the Posse Comitatus. They don't think that the federal government has any kind of jurisdiction, any right to buy land, except by the consent of state legislatures and only for military installations. They think that national parks and other kinds of federally administered public land are essentially tools of oppression, and they're used in particular to dispossess ranchers of their land and to prevent ranchers grazing on public land, which is, you know, the nub of the situation and the conflict here in Honey County. But the hangers-on, I mean, there's some pretty strange people out there. I reported on a guy called John Ritzheimer, who's a notorious internet racist and anti-Islamic guy. There's another guy out there called Blaine Cooper, who's got YouTube videos of him wrapping pieces of bacon with pages of the Quran and setting it on fire. I mean, they're attracting all kinds of elements of the far right to their cause, I would say.
There have been a lot of jokes about them on Twitter, particularly about it being a bunch of hicks. Is that a fair characterization, or are they more upscale than that? I mean, other people are claiming they're millionaire ranchers. So what can you tell about their demographic?
As far as I know, the Bundys are rather wealthy, and there are other ranchers out there, and they're starting to attract local ranchers. There's a guy out there called Lavoy Finicum, who's another Arizona rancher, and I saw him yesterday having a kind of informal constitutional education seminar with some local ranchers. The other guys, the hangers-on, are kind of itinerant activists, I guess. They're the kind of people who get involved with these kind of situations and confrontations wherever they can, and you know, travel around the country doing this kind of stuff, you know, with border militia and things like that. They're men from the Western United States. They are very much in the mold of ranchers and people who live in the Western interior. If that makes them hicks, I guess yeah, they're hicks. But it's probably not good to conflate them with, you know, the Cletus kind of stereotype or whatever. They're wealthy. Ammon Bundy is an articulate guy. He's capable of presenting himself quite capably to the media, and to the extent that they're able to manage the media, they're doing a pretty good job. There's not quite enough of them to deal with the number of journalists who are now out there, and the number of journalists easily outnumber the number of militia out there. But in terms of their presentation, you know, he's quite good, and I don't think he comes across as a kind of backcountry hick. He's quite polished, so I'm not sure where they're getting their media training from, but it's working quite well.
The reporters on the scene now, are they free to wander around, or do the ranchers control access?
It's interesting. There's a kind of rhetorical claim that, you know, people are free to come and go. This belongs to we the people, and that means it belongs to you as well. But in practice, they're actually, you know, there's heavy guys at the front gates who tell you not to come in if you're a reporter. They're letting supporters in and members of the local community in, no problem. But if they know you're a reporter, they're not very happy with you going down into the into the headquarters unless you're on a kind of guided tour like the one we got yesterday.
But they very much want to get their story out.
They do, and they've been successful. I mean, they've been operating in a vacuum. The authorities have been slow to move. I understand that in a sense. I mean, I think they're being quite astute in a way. They're just planning to wait them out. And in a sense, it doesn't really matter if they want to sit out there and freeze. It's, as I said, it's out in the middle of nowhere. But they've also been slow with their own communications efforts. So those guys were really shaping the narrative and controlling that in the early stages of this. The local sheriff's got his act together a little more now, and he's having press conferences. But yeah, I mean, they kind of were able to operate unchallenged and in a bit of a vacuum for the first couple of days.
And aside from the local sheriff, no law enforcement around?
Haven't seen any. I've been told that the FBI are in town. The local sheriff's now set up a kind of incident center at one of the local high schools, and that's where he had his press conference yesterday. It's a federal matter now. Federal agents will be here. The FBI has said it's the lead agency. But they're certainly not evident out at the site. There's free access out there. The roads haven't been blocked. Until now, they've had electricity, cell service. There's really been no evidence of any kind of law enforcement activity at all. One of the guys who are camping out there, who I talked to yesterday, said he'd seen a couple of drones, but, you know, who knows? But there's nothing evident. There's been nothing evident to us.
What are their demands? What do they want?
Well, they're pretty far-reaching. They want the Constitution to be reinterpreted and implemented in a completely different way that recognises what is, in their view, the illegitimacy of the federal government owning and managing land. And they want public lands returned to, Bundy said the other day, to ranchers and people who drive snowmobiles and loggers. You know, they want public land to be, resources to be unlocked, essentially, for people in the western states to use as they used to do. So that means, you know, clear felling trees, grazing as many cattle as you want, and basically de facto management by ranchers of public land. And it's kind of nothing short of that, really. There's no fallback position.
These are a maximalist set of demands that are never going to be met, so they're going to be waiting a very long time.
Yeah, and to tell you the truth, I mean, realistically, I think their main goal is to get attention. It's a pretty dangerous way of getting attention and getting your message out there, but so far it's been successful.
I'm speaking with the journalist Jason Wilson, who is on the scene in Burns, Oregon. Now, what set this off? I mean, there's all this talk of the heavy jail sentences for arson. Is this was this the catalyst for this action?
Yeah, well, a catalyst or at least a pretext. A couple of ranchers, a father and son, Dwight and Stephen Hammond, their property actually adjoins the wildlife reserve. They were backburning. There are conflicting stories about exactly what happened, but in any case, they managed to set fire to some public land. Around 120 acres. They were charged with arson, and each of them served a short sentence. But that was appealed, and then they were sentenced under federal anti-terrorism provisions. And now
the government appealed the sentence, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Because it was too short.
Yeah. And now they have to serve the remainder of their sentences, which are now a 5-year mandatory minimum sentence for terrorism-related charges. Whatever we might think about the legality or the morality of doing that on public land. The problem is that Dwight Hammond is an old man. He's 75, and I saw him the other day, and he's a pretty frail old man. He's not in the most robust of health, you know, from what I saw. Sending him back to jail for another 4 years, you know, that's got a lot of people in the community incensed, and they may not support the tactics of the Bundys, and there's a lot of disagreement in the community about that. But the underlying problem of these people being sent back to jail, it seems fundamentally unjust to a lot of people. And a month or more ago, when it became clear that these people were, with the Hammonds were going to be sent back to jail, a number of militias showed up here in town. There was another major one here called the Idaho Three Percenters, and their strategy was the kind of slightly harebrained legal strategy that these militias often pull, which involves setting up a committee of safety and basically trying to take over the local government and the sheriff and make the sheriff kind of protect these people. That led to a peaceful protest on New Year's Day. After that protest, the Bundys went straight up to the refuge and occupied it. I went to a public meeting when I found out about it, and people were really angry. The other militias and local people were really angry that, I guess, their protest had been hijacked in this way. But, yeah, I mean, militias have heard about this situation and come into town to politically organise people around it, and that's been going on for a month.
And 3%ers? 3% of what?
Yeah, I couldn't find that out. I'm not exactly sure what the 3%ers refers to, but they're another Idaho militia that was founded around the end of last decade, in around 2009, around the same time as the Oath Keepers were. They're a bunch of people from Idaho, which is, you know, a stone's throw away from here. But as I said, their strategy was more legalistic, peaceful, you know, litigious, you know, this kind of crank legal strategy. And they've pulled right back since the Bundys pulled this stunt. So they're kind of laying very low and nowhere to be seen, and I suspect a lot of them have left town.
And you talked a bit about this, but the locals, they have mixed feelings about what's going on?
Very mixed. You know, I think there's almost unanimity on the injustice that's been handed out to the Hammonds. People think that they're being made an example of, and it's difficult to countenance that. I mean, I think someone has decided that they needed to be made an example of, but, you know, I'll stop editorializing. The disagreement is about what tactics are appropriate in these circumstances. And you know, I think that in town, where 75% of the payroll tax comes from government jobs, and that's not considering Social Security or anything like that, there are people who think that doing this on federal land and confronting the federal government in this way is not a good thing. The ranching country surrounding the town, I think there's a lot more sympathy for people going up there and staging an armed occupation of federal land, and there's a lot more willingness to listen to the kind of ideological prescriptions of these people as well. There's disagreement, but I think there's pretty much consensus on the fate of the Hammonds. It's just, you know, what's appropriate to do about it.
And the federal government, you know, you'd think that it would not normally take the occupation of a building that it owns very lightly. The U.S. government is, you know, pretty jealous about its property. Do you have any idea what's going on? Are they just planning to wait them out because the weather is so miserable and now they're not going to have any electricity and, you know, they're sending out pleas for food? I mean, are they just going to starve and freeze them out?
That appears to be the strategy. I mean, I I've had a lot of people asking me on Twitter why the government hasn't sent the National Guard in and making comparisons to other examples of protests where they have done that. I can understand that sentiment, but the thing is that it's quite difficult. It's quite remote. They can see people coming for miles around. You know, an attempt to retake that place by force would involve, you know, an exchange of gunfire and an armed confrontation, and people would probably die. I think that at the moment the strategy is to wait till some of the attention dissipates, you know, gradually shut off services to them and them out. I mean, it is government property, but in a sense it's not government property that matters a great deal. It's a long way from anywhere. It's the Office of the Wildlife Reserve, which is effectively closed for the winter anyway. So I think they're going to try that strategy. The sheriff made an appeal yesterday saying, basically, you've made your point, you know, go home to your families. That's going to be the strategy for now, and we'll have to wait and see if they run out of patience.
And what are they saying in their news conferences about that? Are they aware of this and just determined to wait them out?
Yesterday, Ammon Bundy said that he had heard indirectly through a third party that there would be no attempt to retake the refuge by force. They're kind of aware of that strategy for now. A lot of the press conferences, to be honest with you, are devoted to them reciting their particular eccentric take on what the Constitution means. They're using it to get their messages out there. You know, they're expressing sympathy for the Hammonds, who have now presented themselves to jail and are now back in jail. But really, I think they see this as an opportunity to, yeah, get their messages out there, recruit people, proselytize for their cause, and to be seen as the ones who are really making a stand on behalf of these popular local figures.
And the Bundys? The Bundys, are they at the core of this? Are they an inspiration, a catalyst? What's their role?
Ammon Bundy is clearly the leader. They're calling themselves Citizens for Constitutional Freedom now, by the way. As of yesterday, they gave themselves a name, a band name, as it were. Ammon Bundy is clearly the leader. And a lot of the people up there were also present at the confrontation at the Bundy Ranch. He's the kind of charismatic figure who's at the heart of all this. And there are other people. There's a guy who describes himself as Ammon's bodyguard, who's in charge of security. You know, they've all got their little jobs, but Ammon Bundy is clearly the charismatic figure at the heart of it. And you know, he rose to prominence during that confrontation at his father's ranch and was seen as having been quite physically brave in that confrontation and became a kind of folk hero to a lot of people on the far right, and briefly actually to Fox News until his father made some horribly racist statements and they kind of quietly dumped them. But certainly to the far right, he's a kind of folk hero because of that willingness to stand up to and confront the federal government in the name of what they see as constitutionalism.
And you said the Bundys are Mormons, right?
They are. I mean, the church, the official church, has disowned this action because they're quite aware of the fact that it doesn't look good for them if they don't, I suspect. But yes, they're Mormons, and many Mormons, like them, see the U.S. Constitution as a kind of divinely inspired document. You know, it's not just a pragmatic document about federating a bunch of states. It's something that the Lord inspired. So that gives enormous impetus to this rather fundamentalist, I guess you could say, reading of that document. I think it's difficult to overestimate the role that Mormonism and LDS thought has in the interior of the Pacific Northwest. It comes up a lot in all sorts of ways, and it helps to frame the way people think about politics, and it helps them sweep aside some of the contradictions in their position as well.
You're Australian. Does this strike you as otherworldly, or are you pretty familiar with this stuff by now?
I think the religious angle is something that you wouldn't necessarily come across in Australia, but actually, you know, the part of the country I come from is pastoral as well. There are a lot of people who hate the government and feel like in recent decades that an emphasis on, you know, conservation, just like here, an emphasis on conservation has crept into federal government land management. And, you know, a lot of farmers and ranchers don't like that. It's a familiar story, a familiar conflict. I guess the stuff about armed men is something we don't often get in Australia. But as someone said to me in the central pastime, which is the town bar the other day, the locals aren't too concerned about that because everyone for 100 miles around has a gun. You know, everyone's got a gun. Like, the point for them is the actual occupation and the stand that they're making and whether that's the right thing to do. But, I've gotten more used to that.
All right. Thanks a lot.
That was Jason Wilson, a journalist based in Portland, Oregon, reporting from the scene of the militia occupation outside Burns. You can read his work on the Guardian website. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. The great composer and conductor Pierre Boulez died the other day, age 90. Here's some of Boulez is Alive by Judd Greenstein, one of a group of young Brooklyn-based composers, performed by Molly Markowski. Greenstein told me the title is an allusion to an article by Boulez called Schoenberg is Dead, a denunciation of Schoenberg's lingering attachment to Romanticism, which struck modernists like Boulez as grossly sentimental. Well, here's some of Boulez's second piano sonata, which Greenstein told me inspired the textures of his work, at the end of the program. Thank you. That was some of Boulez is Alive, a statement that is no longer true, by Judd Greenstein, performed by Molly Markowski. Next, Toby Jones. Jones is an associate professor of history at Rutgers who specializes in the Middle East. A mass beheading in Saudi Arabia on January 2nd, which included a prominent Shiite cleric among its 47 victims, made me long for a primer on that terrifying country. Here's Toby Jones to tell us more. Who exactly was this guy that the Saudis executed the other day, the cleric, that has caused so much trouble?
Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr was a member of the Shiite community in Saudi Arabia, which is somewhere around 2 million people have been in Arabia for quite a long time. Al-Nimr was a prominent figure, not so much because of his learnedness or his accomplishment as an actual cleric, although he was critical to some communities in that respect, but mostly because over the last 5 or 6 years or so, he's been an outspoken critic of the Saudi regime, of Saudi human rights abuses, the sectarian discrimination, and was increasingly willing to speak truth to power. He supported the protest movement in the country, participated in it, took to public through various media platforms to be directly critical of the al-Saud, which was clearly intolerable.
And what precisely was he accused of?
Well, the formal charges against him, there's a kind of a weird story that his family disputes that said that he was in a car of 3 or 4 other people who were apprehended by the police upon exit of the vehicle. Somebody in the car apparently opened fire. The police returned fire. He was shot in the leg. He was charged and sentenced to death on grounds of treason, of instigating violence, and for bearing weapons. But the reality is that he was arrested and detained because he was troublesome. He spoke critically about Saudi Arabia and the al-Saud and defiantly refused to be the nice Shiite and to accommodate both the Saudi regime and their abuses of power in the communities that he lived.
What's the makeup of the people that the Saudis execute so virtuosically? It's a mix of criminals and political people, or what's the mix?
Yeah, there were four Shiites. So it was 47 people in total. Al-Nimr has gotten quite a bit of the attention. There were a few other young Shiite men who were also executed, several because of their alleged involvement in the 1996 bombing of the Al-Khobar Towers, as well as another young man who participated in protests during the period of the Arab uprisings. The remainder were either criminals or members of the Al-Qaeda network in Saudi Arabia, some of whom whose activity dated back to 2003 or so. I think that was deliberate to kill al-Nimr alongside a bunch of terrorists. The Saudis want to shape a narrative in which anybody who's restive, like al-Nimr, who is critical, can be collapsed or conflated with terrorists that are more familiar to people like us.
Now, of course, the Saudis are not innocent of supporting al-Qaeda, right?
Yeah, well, they're certainly not innocent historically and complicit directly, much like the Americans, in the rise of al-Qaeda, although I think the Saudis have much more ideological importance in the rise of al-Qaeda. But even more immediately, since the unraveling of the Arab uprising in Syria, it's turned into a civil war, as well as to violence in Yemen, the Saudis have aligned directly with forces that are either al-Qaeda or sympathetic to them.
This is officially tolerated? Officially encouraged? What's the relation of the government to those activities?
Well, the government denounces terrorism generally, and it takes a position in which it claims to collaborate and cooperate with the United States on counterterrorism issues. And it may maintain some distance through official networking. The state doesn't officially come out and say that it's working on behalf or that it's supporting al-Qaeda on its behalf in places like Syria and Yemen. But the reality on the ground is that it's aligned with those forces, whether it's against Shiite rebels or Houthi rebels in Yemen or against ISIS or Daesh in Syria. It's nevertheless found itself a partner in moving parts on the battlefield, as it were.
And let's talk some about the Saudi regime itself. How coextensive is the state with the royal family? Are they one a subset of the other? They overlap? What's the deal?
Yeah, well, I mean, the royal family is, of course, the center of power. The al-Saud are a sprawling family with lots of members. All key positions at the top of government are held by either sons of the original founder or his grandchildren. They occupy all the top ministries, of course, the throne, as well as the direct heirs to the throne. The state is more comprehensive and is bigger than that. I mean, Saudi Arabia is a modern place, right? I mean, it's got ministries with lots of employees and bureaucracies that we would all be able to identify and be frustrated by. But the state is nevertheless dominated by political oligarchy that, in addition to controlling power, also has a direct line to the oil revenues that accumulate in Saudi Arabia. And of course, that's where the real power comes from. So below all of that, the society is entirely beholden to a group of people who control both the checkbook and the police.
That's the twin sources of power. That oil revenue you spoke of, how much of that goes into the family's personal pockets and how much of it goes into the state's revenue?
Well, that's an impossible question to answer. The Saudis are hardly transparent, even though they announce a national budget every year, telling us what they'd like for us to believe is the nature of redistribution and spending. A good chunk of it goes into the pockets of the royal family. I mean, this is an incredibly wealthy family, gold-plated bathroom fixture, or gold bathroom fixtures for that matter. Right. I mean, the records and stories of the opulence of leading members of the family are common and have been around for quite a long time. I think the more important question is, how does the system work? And the system works by taking whatever's left over, and it's a pretty significant amount, but taking whatever's left over and redistributing it in various ways, funneling it into social welfare programs, and accommodating social demands for services and needs. The Saudis don't allow political participation. Now, you can't speak critically. This is what got El-Nimr in trouble. But what you can expect is you can expect some patronage. You can be on the dole, and that's okay. That's under pressure, and I think that has a lot to do with what's going on right now. With declining oil revenues, Saudi Arabia has forecasted about a $100 billion spending deficit. They're not yet slashing spending, but it's not hard to imagine that they'll be in a position where they'll need to. And what does this mean practically? It means things like water, gasoline, electricity, other things that are really cheap could become much more expensive. Jobs may become scarce. Healthcare may become harder to come by. You could see real pressure on Saudi families. Those are things that the Saudis don't anticipate eagerly.
What is the general distribution of income and wealth like? I mean, aside from this very rich royal family, is the rest of the population relatively egalitarian, or is there still a lot of disparity?
There's quite a gap, actually. Saudi Arabia is a big place, probably including expatriates, over 30 million people, maybe closer to 35 today, with three quarters of those being Saudi citizens. The income and oil revenue are not distributed equally. It's disproportionate. I think a couple of years ago, the last time I looked very closely at this, Saudi Arabia's own Ministry of Labor reported an unemployment rate of around 15 to 20%. That's a huge number of folks that aren't working and earning any income. The poverty line in Saudi Arabia is similar to the one in the United States. Up to 2 million Saudis live in difficult socioeconomic conditions. It's hard to explain that if Saudi Arabia was in fact distributing oil wealth equitably. So they're clearly not. And those are sources of frustration across Saudi Arabia as well. But the state is so good at surveilling, and its police capabilities are what you'd expect them to be. So it's hard for anybody to be too critical, let alone to organize an opposition.
And how much of that population is imported foreign labor?
Probably around 7 to 10 million people with a range of expertise and abilities, also reflecting a range of socioeconomic status. There are experts that come in from the U.S., from the West, and from other places. There's also an overwhelming, massive amount of people who are basically indentured servants who come in, they surrender their passports, they surrender their rights to travel. They often work in miserable conditions. I'm talking millions of people in construction, in service industries, and other kinds of basic manual hard labor. They're treated very poorly. It is the modern equivalent to slavery.
Yeah, I was just about to ask. It's really no exaggeration to call it that, right?
No, not at all. I mean, thousands of people die every year. I mean, it's the same thing in the United Arab Emirates and in the other, sort of Arab Gulf states that bring in foreign workers to do things that they can't employ their own citizens to do. And they're just treated roughly and terribly. The human rights record on this is abysmal.
And they're not seen as a source of instability or a domestic threat?
No, remarkably, they're not. But much like poor citizens, their ability to move is tightly constricted. They work so much that it's hard to organize. It's difficult to imagine how they might actually come about being radicalized or militarized. Now, there has been unrest. There's been labor unrest. There have been labor stoppages. And to the Saudis' credit, they have addressed some of this over the last couple of years, attempting to improve conditions. But it's a big hill to climb to overcome and overhaul the entire system. But the answer to your question is no. The foreign workers are not the problem in Saudi Arabia.
I'm speaking with Toby Jones of Rutgers University's History Department. Okay, now let's talk some about the state and religion. What is the relationship of the Saudi regime to Sunni Islam?
Well, the Saudis, of course, have, the Al Saud, the royal family, has a long history of working closely with a particular variant or interpretation of Islam that we often call Wahhabism. And there's all kinds of problems in using that term today. It doesn't have any analytical meaning. But there are a group of scholars and religious figures in Saudi Arabia, clerics and others, who call themselves, or at least who consider themselves, Wahhabi. And this is a group with which the Al Saud have aligned. They've struck a kind of social and political contract where one looks over the state, the other controls the mosque and the public sphere. This interpretation of Islam has changed over time. In its most current iteration, it is dogmatically anti-Shiite. It looks critically at the West and, of course, Zionism, as well as all kinds of other things. So, I mean, the Saudis are not mainstream; they're not adherents of a mainstream version of Sunni Islam. They're proponents of, and in some ways captive to, something much more dangerous.
How is it more dangerous?
If we think about this historically, the founder of the school of Wahhabism is a guy named Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, and he advocated the cleansing of the Muslim community. He basically advocated a kind of violence that wiped groups like Shiites and Sufis out, and he called for either their forced coercion or conversion to a pure form of Islam that, of course, he held whatever the ingredients were, he understood more clearly than others. And this has been a kind of consistent thread that's appeared. It's ebbed and flowed over time, but it's been evident at important moments in Saudi history. And it's back today with a vengeance. It may have gone away in the 1960s and 1970s and at the height of the first oil boom, but it's been rehabilitated in ways that lends credence to fighting wars against Shiites, to calling for the overthrow of Iran, for calling for the overthrow of Assad, for framing a group of mountainous ragtag rebels who want the right to participate in Yemen's government, for deeming them to be some kind of fifth column for the Persian menace. Wahhabism has a lot to do with how those things get articulated and how they're seen as legitimate or credible at the popular level in places like Saudi Arabia.
And then there's a large domestic Shia minority, right? They're not very happy with things.
Yeah, there's about 2 million strong. And one of the things that I've said consistently and that I think bears repeating is that, you know, we're going to be critical of Wahhabism and single it out as a kind of ideological force for no good. But the reality is the Al Saud, although they've aligned with the Wahhabis historically, have nevertheless sought to balance the most extreme versions and iterations of that way of thinking against other social networks in the kingdom, including the Shiites. I mean, the Al Saud stood in the way of the Wahhabis from carrying out genocide against the Shiites in the early 20th century. But what we see today is that the Al Saud have come around to embracing a more extreme sectarian position, being critical of the Shiites. So for the Shiites, they've always been an oppressed minority. They've always been outside of power, and they've always faced the threat of intolerance. The reality today is that they face both state repression, violence from groups like ISIS, which, by the way, carried out 3 suicide bombings against Shiite targets in Saudi Arabia in the past year, as well as more mainstream ways of thinking, the way Wahhabism has kind of become twinned with Saudi nationalism, which requires hostility to Iran and to Shiites most generally. If there's a place in the world where you don't want to be a religious minority, and there are lots of places where it's no good to be a minority, to be outside the mainstream, it's Saudi Arabia.
What is responsible for that turn towards more extremism?
I think it was the invasion of Iraq in 2003, of course, led by the U.S. And the Saudis were at least publicly opposed to the war, and I'm not sure exactly why. They were no friend to Saddam, but I think maybe they were anxious about the possibility of an Iranian resurgence as a rival in the region. But as it became clear in 2004 and 2005 that Iraq was going to be dominated by its Shiite majority, the Saudis understood that they were beleaguered and embattled in the region, or at least they perceived themselves geopolitically to be in a dangerous spot. They began escalating their sectarian language and politics around that time, and they've become more beholden to it and more seriously insistent on sectarianism as a kind of political language as well as a political instrument ever since. So in that way, it's a relatively new thing.
Does this reflect any increasing fear of vulnerability?
I think it's a perception of vulnerability in the region as well as at home. And I'll get to that in just a moment. But I do think that the Saudis see themselves as facing a series of problems. But there's a weird mix here. They also see themselves as enjoying an opportunity, right? They were counter-revolutionary from 2011 to 2015. They supported Sisi's return in Egypt. They've been anti-Assad. They orchestrated a kind of transition in Yemen that was more or less friendly to them and anti-democratic. In this way, they've been the most muscular Arab state. But they still see Iran as a lurking menace, as Iraq as a problem, as the possibility, the potential for either pro-democracy or anti-Saudi movements to emerge at various places. So there's a kind of a blend of strength and a sense of vulnerability there. But they're also where they're most vulnerable is at home. It's domestically. And we talked about declining oil revenues, oil prices and oil revenues, and what that means for the Saudi system. I think it's here, actually, where we gain our most clarity and our greatest understanding of why they would execute somebody like al-Nimr now and provoke a crisis with Iran. And that is to say, if they anticipate an ongoing decline in oil revenues and the potential to have to reconfigure or rethink spending in the social welfare state, that's going to breed discontent at home. And one way to deflect or reorient or distract from possible frustration over social issues is to kill a Shiite and direct attention to sectarian animosity.
And do you suppose they had any idea how much it would provoke Iran?
I think they knew exactly what was going to happen.
And what's in it for them?
Well, I think they gained some traction. They buy some time at home. It's also instructive that they walked away from the ceasefire last week against Yemen. They resumed their full military campaign in the south. I think the Saudis see it as something that buys them a little bit of time.
Well, what they've been doing in Yemen is pretty horrific. I mean, what's behind that?
Well, so the group in Yemen that the Saudis see as problematic is a group called the Houthis, which is a kind of a mountain community in northern Yemen along the Saudi border that had been locked in a long-term struggle with Yemen's central government. In the middle of 2014, they began a march towards Sana'a, and they aligned to Yemen's capital, and they aligned with one of Yemen's ex-presidents, Saleh. And those two forces have worked to throw the pro-Saudi president out of power, President Hadi. President Hadi resigned and fled the country. The Saudis, and then of course he formally requested Saudi intervention. Saudi Arabia began a military campaign last spring that was at least initially airborne, almost exclusively a bombing campaign. It became a ground campaign supported by Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates and Sudan of all places. Over the course of 2015. So what the Saudis claim is that they claim that they're seeking to restore the legitimate government of Yemen, but what they really want to do is they want to destroy the Houthi rebel movement and, of course, in their view, destroy what they interpret to be a group of Shiites. The Houthis are not Shiites in the traditional sense. They're not like Shiites in Saudi Arabia or Iran, at least not the mainstream networks, but they're close enough for Saudi Arabia's purposes to call them that.
The Sunni Shiite spat, how much of this is theological in origin? How much is it a cover for conventional politics?
It's politics. It's all politics. Yeah, the Wahhabis may denounce, and Salafis more broadly, that is sort of similarly minded folks in Egypt or Syria or Iraq or Yemen or elsewhere, may denounce Shiism as a form of apostasy. But that hasn't been a big enough engine for violence or for sectarianism to play out in the context of terrorism or on the battlefield. The fact that wars are being fought and that communities are being targeted because they're different in Pakistan as well, is all about politics and the politics of the modern state, the way that Shiism and Sunni, the way Shiites and Sunnis either do or do not have access to the state power, state authority. It's being called and branded a kind of timeless, eternal Islamic dilemma. But the reality is it's very new. It's very modern.
What was the contribution of the Iranian revolution to these tensions?
Well, it certainly mattered for the Saudi perspective with the rise of Khomeini. I mean, the Iranian revolution was one thing. The victory of Khomeini after the revolution and the consolidation of the Islamic State was something different. Khomeini made clear that the fall of the al-Saud was a Saudi priority, and that predictably soured relations. On the ground, it's more complicated. Saudi Shiites in the 1970s began to become radicalized. They were certainly politicized, and they embraced the revolutionary message out of Iran, even though they were not a fifth column for Iranian interests. And Most Saudi Shiites who became politicized and revolutionary were actually trained either in Iraq or Kuwait by Arab religious scholars. And they rejected some basic principles of Iran, and they didn't cooperate with Iran. States like Saudi Arabia and Bahrain nevertheless perceived them as being Iranian agents. And that legacy has hung over state Shiite relations in the Gulf ever since.
And what about the U.S. rapprochement with Iran? Does that make the Saudis nervous?
I think it absolutely makes the Saudis nervous. I mean, look, we're a long way from the U.S. and Iran having whatever normal diplomatic relations might be. We're a long way from that between the U.S. and Iran. But even this little opening, it's not insignificant. It's a thaw and it's meaningful, but it's also not, you know, the U.S. breaking up with Saudi Arabia. But the Saudis see it as a potentially an existential problem.
But of course, the U.S. loyalty to Saudi Arabia seems to run very deep.
It's unquestioned. It's unyielding. It's not going anywhere. The U.S. just formalized another $120 billion arms deal with the Saudis. They have not been critical of the execution. So far as I can tell, the U.S. has embraced the Saudi narrative over the last 4 days that the Saudis are actually the victims in all of this, even though they're the provocateurs. The U.S. is closely tied to Saudi Arabia, and it will not change, I don't think.
And it's not just Republicans, it's Hillary Clinton and the Clinton family is also very close to the Saudis.
And Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders sees them as a force of stability in the Middle East.
That's remarkable.
Even if he's not on, I mean, the Clintons are a different story, right? I mean, the payroll is one thing, but yeah, ideologically, I mean, this is a mainstream position. There have been some signs of change over the last 5 or 6 years that some in the U.S., including in the State Department, are willing to be more critical of Saudi Arabia, but it is an incredibly difficult challenge to change the policy altogether. It's not hard to understand why, right? Historically, I mean, inertia is one thing. Historically, the U.S. has been close to Saudi Arabia for lots of reasons for so long that, you know, that's a powerful force to maintain course. I mean, the other is that the U.S. has so much invested militarily in the Gulf and in Saudi Arabia that what would be required to reconfigure and undo all of that is almost hard to imagine. So there's no political will to do it.
Yeah, what precisely is the U.S. interest? Is it that they see Saudi Arabia as a force for stability, as Bernie Sanders is?
Well, that's what they say. I don't think they really believe that, but it is the public line. Look, in my most critical and cynical moments, I mean, the argument's pretty clear, and the argument is that Saudi Arabia is a pipeline for expensive weapons systems, and so both the Pentagon and the gun makers profit disproportionately, and so assert and exert considerable influence to maintain the relationship. Officially, if you talk to the White House will say, well, Saudi Arabia collaborates and cooperates on counterterrorism issues. It's important as a balance to Iran, and it's still key to ensuring the flow of oil from the Persian Gulf. I don't believe any of those matter as much as profits from weapon sales.
I recall some Saudi diplomat back in the late 70s, early 80s saying, you're arms dealers and we pay cash. Does that still characterize the relationship?
Seems to capture it pretty well to me.
It is just one of the worst regimes I can think of. You know, all this talk of human rights, the U.S. can never reconsider this intense bond with the Saudis.
From where I sit, and I've been one of those people who contributes to trying to argue exactly this. I mean, I've argued for it for a long time. If we're willing, and not everybody is, and not everybody should be, but if we're willing to go as far as to say that the U.S. does have strategic interests in the Middle East, and Saudi Arabia has strategic interests in the Middle East, I have to be convinced where they actually align. Because from where I sit, they don't. In fact, they're quite distinct from one another. Saudi Arabia wants regional hegemony. It wants the conditions for oil production and oil sales to be such that oil prices are high, even though they've maintained production levels and oil prices are low. That's not really what they want. Saudi Arabia is antagonistic to a kind of broadly stable politics in the region. Saudi Arabia wants hegemony. And these things, they're anti-democratic, they're authoritarian, they're anti-human rights, and their principles don't align, their interests don't align. It doesn't make any sense, which is why ultimately you come back to the conclusion that there must be an awful lot of money to be made in maintaining the relationship.
But if the regime were to fall apart, the country would take a turn in the direction of Syria. All hell would break loose, wouldn't it?
Well, this is true, and I don't, I'm sort of careful to say that I'm not advocating for revolution in Saudi Arabia. That's not up to me, and I would think that some better transition would be possible. And the Bahraini opposition attempted precisely this, and they were quashed unmercifully and mercilessly. And so yes, I think from the American perspective, what was Cheney's old line? Sometimes your friend, whatever he said, you can't choose your friends, and sometimes you don't like them, whatever. The Saudis are in, I agree with you, the Saudis are in the camp of the worst of the worst. But this doesn't actually seem to be troubling to most American policymakers.
That was Toby Jones, an associate professor of history at Rutgers who specializes in the Middle East. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. As I said earlier, we're going out with some of the second piano sonata by Pierre Boulez, who died on January 5th. It's performed by İdil Biret, excuse my Turkish pronunciation. Till next week, bye.